Well, there is a moment in the day when the sun has slipped below the horizon, but darkness has not yet fully arrived. The sky still glows, the air changes, day is ending, and night is beginning. It's a brief moment in time, perhaps 45 minutes, maybe it's an hour long, but Scripture gives that moment in time a name. The time we might call twilight, between sunset and actual dark, is called in Scripture between the evenings. Between the evenings. And it makes perfect sense. You know, it seems odd to me that there could possibly be any debate on this issue. You know how a typical day goes. The sun dips over the horizon, and obviously it's evening. And then an hour or so later, we have actual dark. You know, the stars come out. But as you know, with many details of biblical understanding, if people can find a way to debate it, then we're going to debate it, aren't we? In just a few weeks, we will gather on the evening of Tuesday, March the 31st, to observe the Passover. And at the same time, much of the Jewish world will wait until the following evening to observe the Passover. Why? Are we doing something different? Are they doing something different? Are we a day off? Are they a day off? Or is there something else about that twilight moment that determines everything? Because if Passover is established by its timing, then we can't afford to just move things around, move the starting point around casually. And today we're going to examine why that twilight hour between the evenings is not a small detail. It's a critical moment in time that establishes the entire flow of the 14th day of the first month, otherwise known as the Passover. So let's turn to Exodus chapter 12. We'll begin there. Perfect place to begin when we're talking about the Passover, Exodus chapter 12. Here in Exodus 12, we're going to establish the original instructions for keeping the Passover. So we're about 3 months before Mount Sinai. You know, there is yet to be established a priesthood of Aaron, the Levitical administration, the centralized tabernacle system. Whatever Exodus 12 establishes, it does so before the priestly infrastructure exists. So let's begin reading in verse 3. And as we read this account, you know, I know you've likely read this account 100 times or more, especially as you're preparing for the spring holy days. But I want you to pay very close attention to the details this time, because the details really matter. So verse 3, Exodus chapter 12, "Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb." So the first thing we establish here is that we have a lamb for a household. And if two or three smaller families can gather in one household to share the lamb, we can do that, you know, provided that we have the lamb can adequately feed the number of people that come into the household. So verse 5. "Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats." Another very specific instruction. A lamb of the first year taken from the sheep or the goats. Not an older animal. Not from the herd of cattle. It must be a yearling lamb without or goat without spot or blemish. And so this is an important detail, and we're going to come back to that later in the sermon. Verse 6. "Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight." And there are a couple of important things that we can establish here. First, we've come to the 14th day. Second, we see that it is the people that kill the lamb. And so it's a decentralized system, the individual heads of households. And when do they kill it? The New King James Version says they kill it at twilight. And so that word twilight here, it's translated from the Hebrew word for sunset, but it's the plural form of that Hebrew word. So it's a plural noun, and it's actually translated as between the evenings. So the singular noun would simply be translated as sunset, but the plural noun is between the evenings. And that's the phrase that has come under debate. Now, there are some who view this time, again, it's that time between sunset and actual dark. It's about a 45-minute period of time, and it's the beginning of the day. Sunset is when days end and begin, as you know, and then you have actual dark. So this places the killing of the lamb at the very beginning of the 14th day of the first month. so that all the events that follow, you know, the events of that night and before the next morning, all of those events will be 14th day events. They will be Passover events. And we'll examine those events in a moment to see if it's logical to call those events Passover events. But the other interpretation of between the evenings would have us begin that period of time when the sun is at its zenith, so about noon or high noon, and then it begins to go down. And within that view, there are those who might debate that the period of time is either high noon to sunset, or it could be from the 3 o'clock hour to sunset, 3 p.m. to sunset. Now, both of those views move the event to the end of the day, not the beginning of the day. So the Passover between the evenings perhaps begins at mid-afternoon of the Passover day itself, and then it ends at sunset of the 14th. Now, if that's the case, then the events that follow are going to occur on the 15th day of the first month, the day that Scripture calls the first day of unleavened bread. And so let's read about those events and see if that makes sense to you. Verse 7, we'll see if these events belong on the 15th day of the first month, or do they belong on the 14th? Verse 7, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh of that on that night, roasted in fire. With unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roast it in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails. So they eat the lamb that night. Which night? The night of the 14th or the night of the 15th? Notice also that they're going to roast it with fire. They are not to eat it raw or boiled at all with water. And so that's going to become important later as well. So let's keep that little detail in mind. It cannot be boiled. It must be roasted in fire. Verse 10, you shall let none of it remain until morning, and what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it, with a belt on your waist, and your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. So the animal known as the Lord's Passover is either eaten during the nighttime portion of the 14th day, which is also called the Passover, or it is eaten at the nighttime portion of the 15th day, which is otherwise known as the first day of unleavened bread. Verse 12, for I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Eternal throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. And those are the instructions for the Passover. Because verse 15 is clearly going to go on to start giving instructions for the first day of unleavened bread and the 7 days that follow. Verse 12 says that the Eternal God will pass through Egypt that night and will execute judgment. When he sees the blood on the doorpost, he will pass over that house and show mercy to those inhabitants who are under the blood of the Passover. And verse 14 says that this specific day, not a combination of 2 days, but this one day known as the Passover, the 14th day of the first month, according to the Hebrew calendar, shall be a memorial and shall be kept as an everlasting ordinance. So, to briefly summarize the two positions, in the first case where we have between the evenings beginning at actual sunset and the beginning of the day, then all those events that are known as Passover events, well, they flow naturally into the nighttime portion of the Passover, the putting of the blood on the doorposts, the eating of the Passover meal, and the judgment of the Eternal God over Egypt, with his passing over of those who are under the blood of the Passover. These all happen at the nighttime portion of the Passover day itself. So in the second case, if between the evenings is either at high noon or is at 3 p.m. to sunset, to the going down of the sun, then you only have the Passover lamb killed on the 14th day of the first month, whereas the rest of those nighttime events will occur on the 15th day, or what I might call not the Passover. So you might call the 15th day the first day of unleavened bread, and of course that's correct. But for the purposes of my talk today, I'm going to call the 14th day the Passover, and I'm going to call the 15th day not the Passover. How does that sound? So, and that kind of gives you an idea where I stand on the debate. So that's the issue of timing. Now let's examine why this controversy would even exist. You know, there are good reasons to think this way. And it's not a case of being rebellious or hard-hearted. You know, in fact, the reasonings seem to be very well-intentioned. People are wanting to ensure that the eternal God's instructions are handled correctly and with care. So I think we can give everyone the benefit of the doubt here. So let's carefully go through the issues that have kept this debate alive for all these centuries. So far, we've seen that the heads of the households are in charge of killing the sacrifice. So we have a decentralized system in place here. Remember, there's no tabernacle yet. There's no priesthood of Aaron. There is no Levitical administration. The Aaronic priesthood will be established in Exodus chapters 28 and 29. But we're not there yet. Right now, we're just a people coming out of Egypt. Remember that God tells the Israelites that they are to set aside their firstborn as belonging to him. So the firstborn functions as heads of households, and it's they who serve as priests before God to perform sacrifice. So, you know, again, before the priesthood of Aaron, there was a functioning priesthood in place, and it was fulfilled by the heads of households. You know, we know that Noah sacrificed, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, you know, they all sacrificed. So there was a sacrificial system in place. It just wasn't that detailed Levitical system. And in Exodus 12, we saw again that the head of the household was in charge of sacrificing the twilight sacrifice of the yearlings of the flocks occurring at the evening of the 14th. And that was the system that was in place at the ratification of the original covenant, Exodus 24. But then comes what Galatians chapter 3 calls the added law. The added law, which is essentially Exodus 25 through 40. Exodus chapters 28 and 29 clearly establish that Aaron and his sons are set apart as priests. They're consecrated to handle altar service. They are authorized to perform sacrifices before God. And the handling of blood becomes a priestly responsibility that's conducted at the altar. The administration of sacrificial worship was formalized and it was centralized. Now, before Sinai, again, sacrifice was patriarchal. That is, it's conducted by the heads of the households. After Sinai, sacrifice is regulated. Blood is handled at the altar. Priests descend from Aaron. They mediate altar ritual. So, in summary on this point, the Aaronic priesthood is established, and from this point forward, sacrificial worship is regulated. Blood is applied at the altar, the priests officiate before the Eternal, and worship is no longer domestic, it is administered. But what we don't see, at least not yet, is an actual change in the ordinance of the Passover itself. So what changed was simply the administration of sacrificial worship. So the natural question now is, if the priests now administer sacrifice at the central altar, how does that affect how we keep the Passover practice? Well, before we look at that, let's look at life as a priest from the line of Aaron. And let's turn to Exodus chapter 29, if you could do that. Exodus, the 29th chapter. Now that we have a centralized priesthood, you know, what are they going to be doing day by day? Exodus 29 is going to give us a glimpse into the daily lives of the priesthood. So we'll pick it up in verse 38, Exodus chapter 29 and verse 38. This is day by day what the priests of Aaron are going to be doing. Now, this is what you shall offer on the altar, two lambs of the first year, day by day, continually. One lamb you shall offer in the morning and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. So this happens every day. 7 days a week, 365 days a year, we're offering two lambs of the first year. So what are we going to offer on the fifth day of the second month? Anyone want to take a guess? What are we going to offer the fifth day of the second month? Two lambs. How about the third day of the sixth month? What do you think we're going to offer on that day? Two lambs. How about the 12th day of the 17th day of the eighth month? Two lambs. What about the 14th day of the first month? Oh, that's the Passover, right? Yes, it is. And we're going to offer two lambs. In addition to whatever else is happening on that day, there will be two lambs that are offered. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 28. Numbers, the 28th chapter, is going to mirror what was said there in Exodus chapter 29. We have daily sacrifices. Notice in verse 3, Numbers 28 and verse 3. And you shall say to them, this is the offering made by fire, which you shall offer to the Eternal. Two male lambs in their first year without blemish, day by day, as a regular burnt offering. The one lamb you shall offer in the morning, the other lamb you shall offer in the evening. And now let's drop down to verse 16, Numbers 28 and verse 16. On the 14th day of the first month is the Passover to the Lord. And on the 15th day of this month is the feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. And you shall present an offering made by fire as a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 young bulls, 1 ram, and 7 lambs in their first year. Be sure they are without blemish. And drop down to verse 23. Verse 23 says, you shall offer these besides the burnt offerings of the morning, which is for a regular burnt offering. So these are festival offerings. Now we have daily sacrifices and we have festival offerings. And one doesn't replace the other. They're layered on top of each other. They accumulate. Verse 23 says that these offerings are in addition to what is offered as a regular burnt offering. So what happens to the between the evening sacrifice of the Passover on the 14th day of the first month? Nothing happens to it. It's not replaced with something else. It's still there. At least I'm not seeing that here. We have daily sacrifices added onto that. We have the Passover sacrifice in the evening, but then we have daily sacrifices, and then we have festival sacrifices that are added as well. So if we collapse daily offerings with the Passover and with the festival offerings, if we collapse them all together and call that a singular Passover sacrifice, well, what we're going to end up with is confusion. And it's not necessary. And that's the confusion that's been going on for centuries. And I'm going to demonstrate that here in a moment. But now we're ready to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 16. Deuteronomy 16, this is going to be the crux of the matter, and it's going to be a bombshell. So are you ready for this? Deuteronomy chapter 16. Let's start reading in verse 1. Verse 1, observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Eternal your God. For in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Therefore, you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. Now, wait a second. What are we talking about here? Are you seeing a discrepancy? We're talking about the Passover, right? But are we talking about the evening sacrifice that is to occur between the evenings at the beginning of the 14th day? You know, if there are additional sacrifices happening on the 14th day, what would we call them? We'd still call them the Passover, right? Everything that's happening on the 14th day, or at least is unique to the 14th day, is by definition Passover, right? What else would we call it? So notice what we have here. We are to keep the Passover because in verse 1, the Lord brought them out of Egypt by night. What night did the Lord bring them out of Egypt? The night after the Passover and going into the first day of unleavened bread. Verse 2 says the Passover sacrifice can be taken from the flock and the herd. So we can have beef, cattle in our sacrifice? I thought Exodus chapter 12 was clear that the evening sacrifice had to be a yearling from the flock only. It had to be lamb or goat, not from the herd. Verse 3, you shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it, that is the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. What day did they leave the land of Egypt? They left by night on the first day of unleavened bread. And verse 3 states, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Okay, so we're definitely talking about the end of the Passover and the beginning of the first day of unleavened bread. Therefore, this is not the evening Passover sacrifice. Verse 4, "And no leaven shall be seen among you in all your territory for 7 days, nor shall any meat which you sacrifice the first day at twilight remain until morning." The first day at twilight. This is sunset after the Passover is finished, and we're going into the first day of unleavened bread. You see where confusion is starting to set in. If the Passover sacrifice is a singular sacrifice, then the Passover sacrifice between the evenings has to mean mid-afternoon to the setting of the sun, or else we have a major contradiction here. Because clearly the Passover sacrifice of Deuteronomy chapter 16 is happening at the end of the day, and it's being eaten after sundown into the 15th. But we're already seeing some differences. This sacrifice is commemorating when they came out of Egypt. The evening Passover sacrifice of Exodus 12 commemorates when they were sheltered under the blood of the on the doorpost, and they escaped the judgment that came upon Egypt with the killing of the firstborn. They were commanded to stay in their homes until morning, and then the following evening, the evening of the first day of unleavened bread, what we have come to call the night to be much observed, that is when they left Egypt by night. Now, what else is different about this Passover sacrifice in Deuteronomy chapter 16? It could be taken from the herd. So we've got beef with our Passover meal. Verse 5. "You may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you, but at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide, there you shall sacrifice the Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt." We have a mid-afternoon Passover sacrifice happening here. It's at the time they came out of Egypt. It's in addition to the between the evenings sacrifice. That sacrifice involved the putting of the blood on the doorpost, the blood that protected them from the judgment of the death angel as it passed through Egypt at the midnight hour of Passover. Verse 7, "And you shall boil it and eat it in the place where the Eternal your God chooses, and in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents." Okay, whose head is ready to explode here, right? Now, some of your translations, I think the New King James translation says, "you shall roast it and eat it." But I can assure you, the Hebrew word that is used there is properly translated as boil. And it's the same Hebrew word that's used in Exodus chapter 12, when the Eternal God emphatically said, "you shall not boil it at all or eat it raw, but you shall roast it in fire." Now, why do you suppose the translators chose to put "you shall roast it" instead of "you shall boil it"? Because obviously they had to see this was a major contradiction. I'm assuming that's what they did. Maybe they didn't do that, but anyway. So not only can this sacrifice be from the herd, it can also be boiled. So instead of lamb roasted with fire, we've got beef stew. Beef stew for our Passover. So what is this sacrifice? It is a Passover sacrifice because clearly it's being offered on the Passover. But we've already seen that we can have multiple layers of sacrifices added together. One doesn't replace the other. One doesn't negate the other. We've got daily sacrifices. We've got festival sacrifices. Well, here we discover that we have a Passover sacrifice that is done at a different time than the Exodus 12 sacrifice. It's done with different types of animals. And it's processed and cooked in a different way. The afternoon sacrifice is the Passover sacrifice, but it is not the evening sacrifice of the night before, a yearling taken from the flocks only, and only roasted in fire, and eaten and taken into the home. The bottom line here is that the Passover included more than one sacrifice, which overlapped with multiple layers applied throughout the day, or else we've got a problem. We've got major contradictions. Exodus 12 and Deuteronomy 16 don't work if we combine those as the same singular sacrifice. Now, the first objection to this interpretation, this line of reasoning that I just presented, is going to suggest that, well, it was a centralization issue. The centralization of the tabernacle system, or later the temple, well, that's the reason why the between the evenings Passover of Exodus 12 has to be one and the same with the afternoon Passover of Deuteronomy 16. Because otherwise, how are you going to be able to process all of those lambs in 45 minutes or that 1 hour period of time between sunset and actual dark. So the counter argument to that argument, which I would suggest, is that, well, you're saying that God didn't plan things out very well. You know, he starts off by commanding a sacrifice after sunset and before dark, but then the population grows, things get centralized, and suddenly it's all just too much to do between sunset and actual dark. So we have to switch the time to the mid-afternoon, from mid-afternoon to sunset. And of course, the rabbis have the same problem as I have. Their view of God will not allow for the option that he simply didn't plan things out too well. He didn't take all the variables into account. You know, I can't accept that about God. I know you can't accept that about God. And the rabbis can't accept that about God. And rightfully so. That's why they conclude that between the evenings always meant from mid-afternoon to sunset, or from high noon to sunset. It always meant that, because the alternative is that God didn't think things through. So with their interpretation, the Passover lamb is killed towards the end of the Passover, and the events of the Passover night, the blood on the doorposts, the death angel, and they combine that with the events of the people leaving Egypt by night. They combine that all into one event, which is the night of the 15th. And that is the Jewish Seder, which compresses all those events into one evening. The Exodus 12 sacrifice and the Deuteronomy 16 sacrifice to them are one and the same, even though when we carefully examine the clues surrounding those sacrifices, we can see that they are not one and the same. But what if there's another alternative? What if God knew exactly what he was doing when he placed the between the evenings sacrifice of the 14th at the beginning of the Passover? What if he took into account that the population would grow? You know, after all, scripture records that there were possibly over 3 million people that walked out of Egypt. 600,000 males, not counting women, children, and the mixed multitude. So wrap your mind around that. You know, I got onto Google AI and I asked it, how many cities in Texas has a population over 3 million? It said one, Houston. Every man, woman, and child of the population of Houston walked out of Egypt at night. That's pretty intense. Now, of course, the scholars might even debate that. They'll say, well, 600,000 doesn't really mean 600,000, you know, because they can't wrap their minds around how this can be. You know, you think the children of Israel were complaining when they were out in the desert. 3 million people walk out in the desert. I mean, that's kind of an issue. Where's water going to come from? You know, it was a matter of faith. It took 100% faith to do what they did. And sometimes we're kind of hard on the children of Israel, aren't we? You know, it's like, oh, they lacked faith. But I say, if walking out into the desert with 3 million people. So we're already starting out with a population paradox, but it's dealt with at this point because each head of household was killing the lamb. So again, it's a decentralized system, right? It wasn't left to one high priest at the central location. So let's consider that population paradox a little more closely. So turn with me to Leviticus chapter 1. Leviticus, the first chapter. In Leviticus 1, we're going to see that the people have a part to play in the system. They have a part to play in the way the animals are sacrificed. I mean, yes, the responsibility for administering the sacrificial system has now fallen to the sons of Aaron. But notice the involvement of the people here. So right at the beginning of Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 1. Now the Eternal called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Eternal, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd and of the flock. If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. Then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. Verse 5, He, the individual, shall kill the bull before the Lord, and the priests, Aaron's sons, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So notice who kills the animal. He, the individual who brought the offering to be sacrificed. So again, the people have a part to play in the system. And again, perhaps it's the heads of households, you know, that God set apart as his. They're still part of the system here. So imagine, if you would, a single file line of all the people that came up to Jerusalem. They come up to the temple with their offering. They're standing in line, waiting for that one high priest who is at the altar for their animal to be offered. Now, can you picture that? Now, I'm sure if it's a million people, the line just goes out into infinity. Now, if you can picture that in your mind's eye, in your mind, I want you to draw a circle around that image and put a line through it, because that is not how it happened. There is no way that's how it happened. The argument is that there's no way there's enough time to conduct this offering for all the people if the offering is to occur between that 1 hour between sunset and dark. Well, I submit to you, they don't pull that off between 3 p.m. and sunset either, if a million people are going to stand in line and do that with one high priest. No, there is a more efficient system in place here, and the eternal God who designed this system took the population paradox into account from the beginning. There isn't one single file line to visit one single priest. The people killed their own offering. Thousands of priests were there to handle the blood, while thousands more Levites were there to help process the animal with the cooking and for the offering. So let's demonstrate how that works. And turn with me to 1 Chronicles chapter 23. 1 Chronicles 23, we're moving forward in time. You know, we've gone from the decentralized patriarchal system to the centralized administration of the Levites and priests before the tabernacle. Now we're going to move ahead to King David and King Solomon and the establishment of the temple. We're moving forward in time, and we're moving up in scale and complexity. So 1 Chronicles chapter 23, let's read verse 1. So when David was old and full of days, he made his son Solomon king over Israel. And he gathered together all the leaders of Israel while the priests with the priests and the Levites. Now the Levites were numbered from the age of 30 years and above, and the number of individual males was 38,000. 38,000 Levites. Of these, 24,000 were to look after the work of the house of the Eternal, 6,000 were officers and judges, 4,000 were gatekeepers, and 4,000 praised the Eternal with musical instruments, which I made, said David, for giving praise. Also, David separated them into divisions among the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. 38,000 Levites ready for service at the temple. A choir, an orchestra of 4,000. Can you imagine the music of 4,000? Let's drop down to verse 28 to see this. 38,000 Levites are ready to serve at the temple. Verse 28, because their duty was to help the sons of Aaron in the service of the house of the Eternal, in the courts and in the chambers, in the purifying of all the holy things and the work of the service of the house of God, both with the showbread and the fine flour for the grain offering, with the unleavened cakes and what is baked in the pan, with what is mixed and with all kinds of measures and sizes, to stand every morning to thank and praise the Eternal, and likewise at evening, and at every presentation of a burnt offering to the Eternal, and on the Sabbaths and on the new moons and on the set feasts, by number according to the ordinance governing them, regularly before the Lord, and that they should attend to the needs of the tabernacle of meeting, the needs of the holy place, and the needs of the sons of Aaron, their brethren, in the work of the house of the Lord. So the Levites were set apart to minister to the service of the tabernacle and the temple, and to assist the priests who descended from Aaron. So the following chapter then, 1 Chronicles 24, we're not going to read that, but that will outline how the descendants of Aaron are organized. So we have the sons of Eleazar. 16 chiefs comes from the sons of Eleazar. 8 chiefs comes from the house of Ithamar. So the priesthood of Aaron was divided into 24 courses. Now these courses will serve in rotation at the altar. 24 courses, each for 1 week, which will cover half the year. And then they'll repeat that cycle for the second half of the year. So that each course will serve twice, once every 6 months, and that will span 48 weeks, okay? Again, we have multiple thousands of priests and Levites to serve at this newly established temple. It was structured, it was orderly, and it was systematic. Now, this isn't a village altar in some sheepherder community. This was a fully staffed institution that would rival any modern organized community function that we would see today. You know, what's the largest Feast of Tabernacles that we have gathering in the United Church of God? You know, maybe 1,000 people. I don't know if there was more than 1,000, but probably 1,000 people in one location. You know, how about back in the worldwide days? You know, maybe we had 8,000, 10,000 people in one location. You know, Big Sandy, Texas, all staying in a tent. How many stayed in a tent in Big Sandy, Texas? In a tent? Yeah, yes. I stayed in a tent in Big Sandy, Texas. That was a lot of fun. But 10,000 people, that's a pretty big operation. Here with nearly 40,000 Levites alone, plus the priests of Aaron, and that's just to run the place. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't say how many priests of Aaron was there. If we double it, we could say there's the administration was 80,000. But let's say there was only 20,000 priests. That's still an administration of 60,000 people just to run the place, not counting all the people that are coming up to actually worship God. The numbers are staggering. Let's turn over to 2 Chronicles chapter 5. 2 Chronicles, the fifth chapter. Again, we have a fully functional rotation where each course serves for 1 week, twice per year at the temple. But let's see what happens on special occasions. 2 Chronicles chapter 5 is going to mark a very special occasion. So let's notice it. Verse 1. So all the work that Solomon had done for the house of the Eternal was finished. And Solomon brought in the things which his father David had dedicated, the silver and the gold and all the furnishings. And he put them in the treasuries of the house of God. Now Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief fathers of the children of Israel in Jerusalem, that they might bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal up from the city of David, which is in Zion. Therefore, all the men of Israel assembled with the king at the feast, which was in the seventh month. So not only was this the time of the fall feast, but this was also the dedication of the temple. So we've come to a very special occasion, right? Let's see what's going to happen. Or what do you think is going to happen? A lot of animals are going to be sacrificed, right? Let's drop down to verse 11. And it came to pass when the priests came out of the most holy place, for all the priests who were present had sanctified themselves without keeping to their divisions. All the priests, all the Levites were in a full attendance to serve at the temple and before the altar. So you saw how the priestly rotation of 24 twice per year covers 48 weeks. Well, what about the additional 4 weeks in the year? Well, those would be spaced around the three feast seasons when all the priests and all the Levites will be on duty without keeping to their divisions, as verse 11 there states. It's all hands on deck. And if you want to attach Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 16 to 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 11, you don't have to turn there. I know you know it by heart. Deuteronomy 16 and verse 16, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Eternal your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Tabernacles, and they shall not appear before the Eternal empty-handed. Three times a year, every head of household will appear with their animals for sacrifice. And our infinitely intelligent Creator God anticipated the population explosion, and he designed a fully functional system that would expand to the people's needs. You know, God did not centralize worship without taking this into account. He didn't command a national pilgrimage without staffing the altar. David organized the priests into weekly courses for ordinary time, but on the holy days, the divisions dissolved and the nation's full priesthood stood ready. Now, to the argument, there's no way that many lambs could be killed in one window between sunset and dark. Yes, there is, because God built a scalable system that would allow it to be handled. Let's go even further in time, and we're going to see how this marvel of expansion was able to function. So turn with me to 2 Chronicles chapter 35. Here in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, we're going to move into the reign of Josiah. King Josiah is about to perform an unforgettable Passover that is going to go down into the history books. In verse 7, Josiah gives 30,000 lambs and goats from the flocks to the people for keeping the Passover. He also gave 3,000 cattle, 30,000 lambs and 3,000 heads of cattle. In verses 8 and 9, we see the leaders also donated multiple thousands of animals. Again, this is not a village Passover. This is a national scale, tens of thousands of animals. Now let's read verses 10 through 14, and we're going to notice the systematic planning of this. Not chaos, order. 2 Chronicles chapter 35 and verse 10. So the service was prepared, and the priests stood in their places, and the Levites in their divisions, according to the king's command. And they slaughtered the Passover offerings, and the priests sprinkled the blood with their hands, while the Levites skinned the animals. So notice that division again. They slaughtered the animals. Who slaughtered the animals? The people. They, the heads of households, slaughtered the animals. The priests sprinkled the blood, and the Levites skinned the animals. The people with the fully staffed Levitical administration all working together to make this happen. Verse 12. Then they removed the burnt offerings that they might give them to the divisions of the fathers' houses of the lay people to offer to the Eternal, as it is written in the book of Moses. And so they did with the cattle. Also, they roasted the Passover offerings with fire according to the ordinance. According to the ordinance? What ordinance? Exodus 12 commands that there are Passover offerings, yearlings from the flock, that must be roasted with fire. They roasted the Passover offerings with fire according to the ordinance, but the other holy offerings they boiled in pots, in cauldrons, and in pans, and divided them quickly among the lay people. They boiled the offerings taken from the cattle. These do not replace the roasted sacrifice of the flock. As we've seen, we're adding to the system. We're not doing away with anything. And this ties back into Deuteronomy chapter 16, doesn't it? It helps resolve Deuteronomy 16 and Exodus chapter 12. We've got between this evening sacrifice, we have the daily sacrifice that happens every day, including on the 14th day of the first month. We've got the afternoon sacrifice, and we've got festival sacrifices. Now think about this. If anything, moving the evening sacrifice to the mid-afternoon would not make their lives easier. It would make it more complicated. Why would we do that? We have 24 hours of Passover to work with, and we're going to take the evening sacrifice and we're going to move it to the mid-afternoon where there's other sacrifices already going on. I mean, again, that's just going to make things complicated. You have the daily sacrifice and you have the festival sacrifices. So why would you do that? You know, make it make sense, right? Verse 14. Then afterward, they prepared portions for themselves and for the Levites. They prepared portions for themselves and for the priests, because the priests, the sons of Aaron, were busy in offering burnt offerings and fat until night. Therefore, the Levites prepared portions for themselves and for the priests, the sons of Aaron. They were busy into the night. Now, they aren't required to huddle in their homes under the blood of the doorposts every year, right? That incident with the death angel is a one-time event, as you know. The sacrifices began at sundown on the Passover, the 14th day of the first month. The Levites prepared for themselves and for the priests because the priests were busy offering into the night. So this shows extended sacrificial activity, multiple offerings overlapping while the priests are kept occupied continuously. And that supports a layered system where sacrifices are overlapping rather than canceling each other out. The altar was not idle during any portion of the Passover time. The altar was active all day. What began in Exodus chapter 12 as a household ordinance has now been incorporated into a fully staffed, national, scalable sacrificial system. But if that historical journey from the children of Israel in Egypt and that first Passover night, all the way to that memorable Passover account of King Josiah, if that wasn't convincing enough. You know, we've demonstrated that the sacrifices of the Passover are plural, they're layered, and they're overlapping throughout the day. If that Old Testament historical narrative is not enough to convince you, then I've got one more ace in the hole. We've got a commentary on the Old Testament that will trump the greatest minds of rabbinical Judaism. And you know what that commentary is, don't you? It's the New Testament. because the apostles themselves are going to interpret the death of Jesus Christ within the Passover framework and the timing and the sequence. But before we look at that Passover sequence in the Gospels, let's turn to Ephesians chapter 2, if you could. I want you to notice something here that is said in Ephesians. I've actually seen, in direct relation to this Passover timing argument, I've seen this statement made, and I'm paraphrasing, "How can you Church of God people be so arrogant as to think you have this right, while centuries of biblical scholarship got it wrong? No one else does this. The Jewish world does not recognize the evening of the 14th. And of course, people in mainstream Christianity, they don't celebrate Passover at all. So really, the only people that gather on the evening of the 14th, as far as I can tell, are people whose roots originate with the worldwide Church of God. Now, maybe there's others, but that's pretty much it. So are you so arrogant as to think your little insignificant group got this right while all the scholars got it wrong?" Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 20. "Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone." The way we establish doctrine is by building on the foundation of the apostles, the New Testament, and the prophets, the Hebrew scriptures, with the gospels of Jesus Christ. You know, as smart as the Jewish rabbis are, and they are smart, they don't have the foundation of the apostles. As smart as the scholars of mainstream Christianity are, they don't have the foundation of the prophets when they consider that God's laws are done away, and therefore they aren't keeping God's holy days at all. The only people that are going to get this right are those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith and testimony of Jesus Christ. And that's a description that's given in two places in the book of Revelation to describe the true people of God. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 17, Revelation chapters 14 and verse 12, memory verses that clearly identify the only people that Jesus Christ recognizes as his when he returns. That's our ace in the hole. That's how a simple people are able to put the pieces together when the greatest minds of biblical scholarship are left floundering over the centuries. Now let's put the pieces together from the New Testament concerning the timing of the Passover events. We can assemble the pieces from the Old Testament alone, but the New Testament is going to seal the deal. Let's go to Luke chapter 22. Luke, the 22nd chapter. All four gospel accounts tell this story basically the same, and all four clearly identify what Jesus and his disciples are going to participate in is a Passover meal. No question. But I like the way Luke's gospel reads here, so that's the version I chose. So let's notice that. We'll start reading in verse 11, Luke chapter 22 and verse 11. "Then you shall say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room that I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' Then he will show you a large furnished upper room. There make ready. So they went and found it just as he had said to them, and they prepared the Passover. When the hour had come, he sat down and the 12 apostles with him. Then he said to them, 'With fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer.'" Notice the details that emerge here. We know this is the evening before Jesus Christ will suffer and be crucified. This gathering of the 12 with Jesus the night before is without a doubt the evening portion of the Passover. The time is after sunset, and we're entering into the 14th day of the first month. We're entering into someone's house. So to be able to eat the Passover, to legally be able to call this meal the Passover, as Jesus Christ plainly does, I'm assuming a yearling from the flock had to be processed properly by the temple administration. The blood had to be handled properly. And then the prepared Passover was brought into someone's home, just as they did in Josiah's time. They handled the roasted offerings, they distributed it to the people, and they took them into their home. That is the only, as far as I know, the only sacrifice where it's done that way, done in somebody's, taken into the home. So the blood had to be handled properly. The prepared Passover was brought into someone's home for a household Passover meal. It says the hour had come. So timing is important here. And the part I like about Luke's gospel is how Jesus tells his disciples, with fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you. So I just think that adds a little more emotional intensity that Jesus had on this evening, which he called the Passover. But now what's going to happen? People may debate the timing of the events of the Passover, but one thing is clear. The process for Jesus Christ begins in the evening of the Passover. And what follows that momentous dinner? He goes out into the garden at night. He prays perhaps the most intense prayer that we as outside spectators have ever been privy to hearing. So let's drop down to verse 44 and notice that. Luke 22, verse 44. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like drops of blood falling to the ground. When did the sufferings of Jesus Christ begin? It says here that he was in agony. The mental anguish that Jesus Christ felt at this moment. You know, can we count that into the sufferings that Jesus Christ suffered? Is this the beginning of his long Passover night? What follows this moment of prayer then is betrayal from a friend. You know, how painful is that? And the night goes on. He's arrested. He's questioned. He endures trials and religious examinations and beatings. His friends are scattered. All this happens before dawn. This is the night of the Passover. What happened in Egypt on the night of the Passover? Judgment happened in Egypt. The firstborn was judged and condemned on Passover night. Christ's sufferings didn't begin during the daytime hours of the Passover, not the noon hour and not the 3 p.m. hour. The sufferings of Jesus Christ began during the night. In the Gospels, Christ is arrested at night. He is tried at night. He is mocked at night. He is beaten at night. He is condemned at night. The night of Passover in Egypt was a night of judgment. The night before the crucifixion was also a night of judgment. But this time, it's God the Father's own firstborn who stands in the place of the condemned. We then move through the daytime portion of the Passover. Jesus Christ is beaten and condemned by Roman officials. He is crucified, and he dies at around the 3 p.m. hour. Let's notice the account in John chapter 19, if you could turn over there. John the 19th, we're going to establish with ironclad evidence that Jesus and his disciples observed a domestic Exodus 12-style Passover meal on the evening portion of the Passover and not the mid-afternoon slot going into the first day of unleavened bread. John chapter 19 and verse 30. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. We were just talking about that before services, right? Bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. Therefore, because it was the preparation day that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. This is the smoking gun, brethren. We know that he suffered and was crucified before the annual holy day. And that high day can be none other than the first day of unleavened bread. Therefore, what they, Jesus and his disciples, called the Passover meal had to be the evening portion, the nighttime portion of the Passover. And as we see here, he dies mid-afternoon on the Passover day itself. But note now, 3 p.m. is not the start of his Passover sufferings and sacrifice. It is the end of it. Passover begins at night. And if Christ's sufferings begins at night, then why would we reduce his Passover to that single afternoon timestamp? And we know that there are other sacrifices going on throughout the day. So the fact that we have sacrifices occurring at the 3 p.m. hour, the 3 p.m. hour or later, well, that's not really the correlation that we're looking for. For that instant in time when Jesus died on the cross, we don't have to say, well, they slaughtered the lamb at exactly the 3 p.m. hour, and that's exactly when Jesus died. So that must be the analogy of the Passover lamb to die at the 3 p.m. hour. And then if someone really wants to stretch the analogy force the analogy, they might say the evening Passover sacrifice was changed and moved to the 3 p.m. hour so that it lines up with the instant that Jesus Christ died. Brethren, that's stretching the analogy too far. We can't make the lamb fit the analogy that closely, not the singular Passover lamb. We can't make it fit that closely in a second-by-second playback. It doesn't work. You know, otherwise, what would we have to do to that singular Passover lamb to make it match the sacrifice of Jesus Christ? Well, I suppose we could start by tormenting it at night. We'll beat on it. We'll keep it up all night. We'll mock it. We'll humiliate it. We'll do this to a yearling lamb of the flock. We'll beat on it. We'll humiliate it. We'll jam a crown of thorns onto its head. And then during the day, we'll stretch it out over a piece of wood. We'll drive nails through its feet. And we'll hang it up and we'll watch it slowly bleed to death at the 3 p.m. hour. Thankfully, God is not so cruel as to make a yearling from the flock suffer like that every year for centuries upon centuries, just to match the analogy before Jesus Christ fulfills it. We don't do that with the Day of Atonement sacrifice. I mean, that sacrifice matches the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the one where he brings the blood into the most holy place. We don't move that to the 3 p.m. hour of Passover day. It's done. All the sacrificial system points to Jesus Christ in one way or another. So we don't have to move it to the 3 p.m. hour. Let's move now to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And we'll let the Apostle Paul wrap this up and put a bow on it. Paul's having a Passover discussion with the members of Corinth. So let's pick it up in verse 23. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. What does the Apostle Paul anchor the Passover to? What does he focus in on when he's talking about the sufferings and death of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ? Paul does not anchor the memorial of his sufferings and death to the afternoon of the crucifixion. Paul does not anchor this most important moment in the history of mankind to the 3 p.m. hour of his death. He anchors it to the night, and not just any night, the night of betrayal, which in the gospel sequence is the Passover night. Let's notice something else here that we see in the letter to Corinth. Let's back up to verse 20. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 20. Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper, for in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry and the other is drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. Something occurred to me here, and it's only been while I've been spending so much time developing this message and scrutinizing so closely the events of the Passover night and day. Paul tells them to eat their meals at home before they come together to participate in the covenant symbols. Now, could Paul be telling them to eat at home because Passover as a meal belongs at home? It's just speculation, you know, but is the Lord's Supper the full Passover meal that the Corinthians were trying to recreate? And Paul tells them, no, don't do that. If you're hungry, eat at home. Now, he may not be making a technical Passover argument there, but clearly he's separating ordinary eating away from the New Covenant ceremony of remembrance. The Apostle Paul has a way of distilling things down to what really matters. And what really matters about the Passover? You know, what is the Passover? Back in chapter 5 of this same letter to Corinth, Paul tells us that Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. So what is the Passover? Jesus Christ is the Passover. And that's distillation. The memorial is not a full reenactment of the Passover meal. It's a proclamation of the new covenant. Paul says, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death. Notice what is emphasized. Not the lamb, not the herbs, not the full feast. Paul emphasizes the bread which was broken for us. He emphasizes the blood which was shed for us. And he emphasizes the death which he died for us. And Paul preserves the memorial within the night setting. He keeps the symbols of the new covenant, and that is the New Testament Passover. And that's pure distillation. Now, you think the story ends there, don't you? You think I'm going to go sit down, don't you? Not yet. I have one more historical postscript to add. Let's move ahead a few centuries. Few centuries from the New Testament. Where could we possibly go from there? Where would that possibly take us? It takes us to something known in church history as the Quarto Deciman controversy. The term Quarto Deciman simply means 14th, referring to Christians who insisted on observing the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, according to the Hebrew calendar, just as the apostles had taught. Around AD 190, a bishop named Polycrates of Ephesus wrote to defend this practice. In a letter to Victor I, he explained that faithful leaders before him, including John the Apostle and Polycarp, had all kept Passover on the same date. This account is preserved by the historian Eusebius in Ecclesiastical History, Book 5, Chapter 24. Polycrates writes, quote, "All these observed the 14th day of the Passover according to the gospel, deviating in no respect." Now, this is not controversial. No one familiar with early church history disputes that there were Christians known as the people of the 14th, the Quarto Decimans. The debate continued for nearly two centuries before the Roman church eventually standardized Sunday observance, what has come to be known as the Easter Sunday, at the First Council of Nicaea, AD 325. But now here's the question, and I'm going to make this as simple as I can. We've already seen that the heart of the Passover controversy comes down to the phrase, between the evenings. Does it mean sunset to dark at the beginning of the day? Or does it mean mid-afternoon to sunset at the end of the day? If you believe the latter, then you know the only thing that happens on the 14th is the killing of the lamb towards the end of the day. That's the only thing that happens on the 14th. Everything else happens on the 15th. And of course, that is the Jewish Seder, as we've already seen. Now, here's a painfully obvious question, if you haven't picked up on it yet. Why call the Christian Passover observers the people of the 14th? You know, according to that interpretation, the only thing that happens on the 14th is animal sacrifice. But Christians aren't doing animal sacrifice anymore. After the destruction of the temple, the Jewish people aren't doing animal sacrifice anymore. So what exactly is left to do on the 14th? Nothing. Everything would happen on the 15th. You see where this is going, right? They wouldn't be quarto decimans, they would be quinto decimans, right? There's a term for you, quinto decimans, the people of the 15th. But the historical record says otherwise. And if those believers were careful enough to preserve the Lord's Passover on the 14th, at pain of death, to be called themselves the people of the 14th, then they were careful enough to also follow the Apostle Paul's instructions to take the Passover symbols on the same night in which he was betrayed. People may debate the timing of the meaning between the evenings, but there is no debate about this one thing. The betrayal happened at night. So if they were observing the memorial on the night in which he was betrayed, and they call themselves the people of the 14th, I rest my case. The Passover in Egypt began in the evening, just after sundown, on the 14th day of the first month. Judgment was executed on Egypt on Passover night, the 14th day of the first month. Christ's sufferings began at night, the 14th day of the first month. The symbols of his sacrifice were given at night, the 14th day of the first month. And Paul tells the church to remember him with those symbols on that same night, the 14th day of the first month. The afternoon sacrifices of Passover were additional sacrifices that were layered upon the day. We had the evening sacrifice of the Passover. We had the daily sacrifices. We had the festival sacrifices in the afternoon of the Passover as we approached the first day of unleavened bread. These were the sacrifices of the Passover. And that's the title of my sermon today, The Sacrifices of the Passover. And I hope you noticed that the word was in plural. The sacrifices of the Passover did not cancel each other out. One did not replace the other. One was not combined with the other. Rather, they were layered one on top of the other. The Jewish people today will gather on the evening of the first day of unleavened bread to celebrate the Seder. They're not wrong. It's a valid celebration. You know, we in our church tradition call it the night to be much observed, and we'll celebrate that night as well. It's the night we commemorate the eternal God leading his people out of Egypt. That did happen. Am I overdue? Is that the red light that's starting to flash? You're going way too long, aren't you? But that did happen on that night. On the evening of the 15th, the people were led out of Egypt. But the only mistake I see at this point is that the Jewish people have compressed all the events of the Passover and the night of the first day of unleavened bread into one singular event. So they'll call the sacrifice correctly, the Passover sacrifice, but then they take the killing of the lamb, the evening meal, the placing of the blood on the doorposts, the judgment of the death angel, the passing over of the people with the blood under their doorposts, with the children of Israel walking out of Egypt the following night. But instead, they'll do it all in one night. This year, on the evening of Tuesday, March the 31st, we will gather to commemorate the Passover evening. On the following evening, Wednesday, April the 1st, we will gather to celebrate the night to be much observed. It's what the Church of God has been doing for decades. Yes, we're a small group. Yes, we're doing it entirely differently than virtually all of biblical scholarship. And is that arrogant? Maybe. Or maybe it's just plain correct. Unapologetically correct. It's a correct alignment to commemorate the sequence of events that began between sunset and dark, between the evenings, at the beginning of the 14th day of the first month known as the Passover. This is doctrine, brethren, and it is doctrine that is built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, with Jesus Christ being the chief cornerstone. And we are able to correctly build on that foundation, not because we're the smartest people in the room, but because we, quite simply, keep the commandments of God and have the faith and testimony of Jesus Christ.